My name is Nicole Flattery, and welcome to the Stinging Fly podcast. My guest today is Susie Dickey. Susie Dickey's poetry and fiction have appeared in Poetry London, the Dublin Review, Poetry Ireland Review, the White Review, and her fiction has been broadcast as part of the BBC Radio 4 short work series. Her previous novel, Tennis Lessons, was published in 2020 by Doubleday UK, and her most recent novel, Common Decency, was published just a few months ago. The story she's going to talk about is How They Live Now by Wesley.
A dog is an impossibility. It will slow us down. Dogs have been around for 10,000 years. They were the first domesticated animal. They lived around the campfires of prehistoric man. A dog will need feeding. There won't be enough food to go around. What if I gave the dog some of my food? It won't work. Would you give me your food? Would you share your ration? Of course, I would give you my last bite. Would you give me your overcoat? I would give you anything and everything. She stares at her husband's thin red lips, his big square teeth, too many for his mouth. Would you eat me? If it came to it, would you eat me? Of course not. A dog is a frivolous thing. How can you even think about it in the days ahead? That may be ahead, she reminds him. We have to keep ourselves free, so we can leave at a moment's notice, at the drop of a hat. Yesterday she watched a dog running to and fro, back and forth to its master. A golden Labrador who had wriggled its way out through the car window when an old woman had parked. The woman had thrown a stick and the dog had jumped into the river. No thought of the cold, of being sodden afterwards. He's brave, she'd told her. He's mad, the old woman said, while the dog leapt and cavorted for the stick. They will never own a house. They will not own bricks and mortar. Nothing you cannot leave, nothing you cannot carry with you. She slept on a camp stretcher for 3 months until she spit the dummy. They had a stretcher each. He would crawl to her in the night. She made him get a double mattress. He would not buy a bed frame. No bed legs, no bed frame, nothing so big we cannot carry. We must live like travellers, he tells her. She stares at the long cord around his neck, at his photograph dangling on the security swipe. She tries to imagine the door he swipes but never gets past the glass. It would be glass. They are always glass. She doesn't actually know what he does. He wears a suit and tie and works from 8 a.m. until 5 p.m. in the city. Of course she knows what his job is, but she doesn't know what he does. He's gone through a series of jobs that are all the same and not interesting to her. She knows he does something all day, and that's enough. And in the beginning, when he joins a new firm, he seems to like it. She grows most of their food on an allotment by the river while he works. Working for money doesn't mean anything, he tells her. Having skills, being able to do things we will need, like hydroponics and smoking fish, trapping animals, being able to kill animals you can eat, that's what's important. She has tried to get a job, but there are no jobs. No one is hiring. She knows he has a desk, and each day she asks him what he had for lunch. He tells her things that are ongoing with one person or another. She remembers some of their names. They are abstract figures he has fleshed out, but not too much. He doesn't describe people unless she asks, and then he doesn't do a good job. Not like she would. She would know all the gossip. She would know the way they breathed. Did you put my photo on your desk? She asks him. Not yet. Why not? You have to do these things slowly. Show people a little bit about yourself at a time. You have to keep yourself safe. From what? Marauders. She imagines the plastic frog she bought him and her photo in the silver frame. All the paraphernalia, the cards, each card she made and he made for her, crowding his desk, crowding out everything. The man who sits at the desk next to him, his wife handed him a baby in the middle of the night, umbilical cord attached and everything, which she thought only happened in books. His wife woke him and said, "Here, take this." And she handed him a baby. She didn't even know she was pregnant. He tells it like it's funny, an amusing anecdote. He's from Norway, he tells her. She imagines salted fish, jangling reindeer bells, his ruddy, raw-boned face. What does he look like? Short, dark, average. What's he like? He's an okay guy. What does he have for lunch? Burger King, every day a double quarter pounder with cheese. What else? He eats boiled sweets. What kind? Oddfellows mints. There's always a packet open on his desk. Does he offer them around? Not really. The last place where her husband worked, he came home from his leaving do and said, the biggest surprises were the ones who were larger than life. It was a bizarre thing. Arms around these people, and they were so small, their clothes crumpling in on all these tiny frames, collapsing like balloons. She starts writing dog on notes around the house, under his pillow, under the bathroom cabinet. When he picks up his coffee cup, he sees dog. Folded inside the butter conditioner, he reads dog. Stuck to the bathroom mirror with blue tack, dog, dog, dog.
So firstly, why did you choose that story?
I read a few, and this one, I think, really struck me in that how, because, you know, something I'm really interested in at the minute is this kind of idea of eco-literature, yeah. of what it should mean right now to be trying to write in response to the climate crisis. And what really struck me with that story was how it felt subversive, not so much just in terms of its content, but in terms of the shape of it as a story, in that it's not conforming to any kind of conventional or linear notion of narrative. Mm-hmm. You know, it's holding so much back, and in that way feels like it's making us kind of question what language can do, what narrative can do, what a kind of strategic notion of like causation might be. And it's asking all these questions but answering none of them. Mm-hmm. And I feel like that's probably formally and linguistically and syntactically the most kind of aberrant, rebellious thing you can do with literature, is to not conform to any of the shapes that literature might be thought to need to hold. Because, you know, the thing about, you know, the climate crisis is, and I was reading this Timothy Morton book called Being Ecological. Actually, speaking of, did you see Timothy Morton at All Points East? Do you know No. Timothy Morton?
No, I don't know.
Yeah, they're this incredible philosopher. But yeah, we saw them just rambling about at All Points East. And
I didn't see anyone. I've tried my friend.
Well,
I just about saw you, Susie.
But yeah, we saw them standing looking at a kind of map of the festival, and then we stood and watched them watch the map, and then we watched them walk away. And it was really the highlight of the day. But yeah,
I haven't read any of their work.
But yeah, so in this book, Being Ecological, they talk about object-oriented ontology, which is this kind of philosophical school of thought that's all about decentering a notion of human hierarchy, and, you know, coming to reframe the world as more symbiotic and less kind of, not humans having dominion over anything. And I feel like so much that has informed and fueled this fallacy of human hierarchy is how we use language and how we think that separates us, how we think that sets us above other species because they don't use language in the way that we do. And we think that we have created this system of signs and symbols that are entirely ours to control. And narrative, I think, feeds into that in a big way, especially prose narrative and novel writing and story writing, and this idea of an arc and this idea of causality. And I think formally what really drew me to this story was it was calling into question those things. Mm-hmm. And it seemed to be trying to dismantle that that control, not just in terms of the shape of it, but in terms of how little we get of these characters. You know, they are so clearly not in control of their own moment. They are preparing for an eventuality they're not sure will come. And in attempting to prepare for that, they are living in this way that seems kind of maniacally in control, maniacally like despotic, but is clearly a bit kind of wild and frenetic and not conducive to a normal way of life. And so, yeah, it felt really, really interesting to me as a story.
Mm-hmm. I hadn't read the story until you picked it. And one thing I do really enjoy is when you're very in this character's mind more than.
Yeah.
And I think you do something similar in your own work, of course. I just read Common Decency and Tennis Lesson. Can you talk about that? I don't think you're interested in plot in the. How do I say this? I'm not interested in polite, but how do I say that politely?
there's this bit in The Purr Mouth by Flann O'Brien where this government representative is going round all the purr Irish houses and a stipend will be given to, it goes up in increments depending on how many English-speaking children you have in the house. And this one family, the protagonist family, there's just one of him, but what they do have is a load of piglets, and they hear through the grapevine that the person coming round is a bit unmotivated, a bit disinterested, and also of very poor eyesight. So they dress the piglets up in hats and children's clothes, and as a result, trick this guy into giving them the stipend for every one of these piglets as though they were English-speaking children. And I feel like that's kind of what I'm doing in my novels. It's a pig, but I'm putting a hat on it and calling it a novel so people will give me money. But it's not a novel.
It is a novel. It is a novel. Of course, they're brilliant novels. But I feel that, yeah, you're much more willing to follow in Common Decency, for example, like Siobhan's like kind of train of thought, and how time works for her. Than sticking strictly to some idea of this has to happen. This has to happen. Can you talk about that?
Yeah. Because, something I really wanted to do in it was, in having this dual narrative, I wanted you to see how both narrators' perspectives are feeling, how they are feeling to conceive of what is truly going on around them. But also, when you put those two together, how they don't even sit neatly to build up a composite reality, even together you're getting more information but you're still not getting truth, if there is truth, if there can be like mimetic truth in fiction. That's a question for another time. part of what I was interested in was, these flights of introspection, how time is changed by experience, how there is no kind of objective experience of the passage of time, that it is entirely derailed, sped up, truncated, concertinaed by these moments of intense self-fixation. And that's kind of what I wanted the vibe there to be.
Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit about Common Decency? I realize I didn't even introduce it.
it's 12 paragraphs in a trench coat.
It really tricked me. I thought it was really good.
You got to the end of it and you realized it was actually just a menu for Pizza Hut.
Best book I've ever read.
So Common Decency it's about these two women of a kind of ambiguous age living in the same apartment building in Belfast. Belfast famously being the Paris of Belfast. And one of them, Lily, is kind of experiencing this moment of intense stasis fueled by grief. Her mother has recently died of pancreatic cancer. And in response to this, she has kind of worked very hard to winnow away her life, to kind of resect herself and enclose herself in this kind of tomb of this apartment building so she can do nothing but reminisce and focus on acts of remembering. Then above her, Siobhan lives. Siobhan is a primary school teacher, kind of much more conventionally gregarious, extroverted, kind of highly ambitious, loves her job, but is having an affair with an older academic. And the nature of that relationship is causing her to kind of undergo a sort of mirrored experience to that which Lily is undergoing, where she has placed at the kind of nucleus of her life this relationship and is trying to shuck off anything that can encroach upon that, anything that can detract or distract from that relationship. And Lily, as a consequence of her circumstances, sort of becomes fixated upon Siobhan because Siobhan represents to her everything that she no longer has. Which is, you know, closeness, intimacy, a sense of purpose. And she begins to construct this idea in her head that Siobhan will save her. Siobhan will be her kind of salvation. But then following a sort of inauspicious encounter in the stairwell, where it becomes apparent that Siobhan is thinking of nobody but herself, Lily's kind of hope for their kind of nascent relationship becomes curdled, and she decides to take revenge. Seems like too strong a word, because I feel like, you know, you say the word revenge and people get very excited.
Yeah, they do. They think there's going to be crime.
Exactly. There's no crime. So the kind of novel is about that, about the subjectivity of experience, how we can't know other people, how we construct narratives for others in order to justify our own behavior, to try and kind of make ourselves legitimate. The ultimate failures of that. And I'm kind of hoping that through that, I am maybe gesturing to this idea that individualism is not sustainable as a model of living, of thinking, which I think, you know, maybe drew me to the Wesley story, because I think formally Wesley is also exploring that idea.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and something I really like about your work, and I've noticed in both books, is that you don't, in a way that it feels like real life, it's very hard to separate there are no big moments from the big moments from the small moments, you know, that there is a sort of, especially I saw that in tennis lessons, the way that you, like, life just goes on and there is no pivotal, and the things that you realize were pivotal later, you don't realize at the time. Mm. What do you think of meaninglessness in fiction?
Ooh.
Ooh. I think we're just so used to everything adding up that it's hard for, like, and even when things don't add up, our brains try and make them cohere and add up. And I think that's something that you purposely avoid in a very interesting way.
Yeah, well, I read this piece the other week by Elif Batuman, and she was talking about the nature of the creative writing MA in American universities. And she said, you know, a big hangover of these kind of programs is they insist upon the arc and narrative causality and plot. And she said, you know, that's a very Western idea of what literature needs to do. And that to insist upon it is actually a kind of strange Orientalism. And like a kind of, you know, colonial projection thing. And I, you know, I'm not going to say that that's what I'm thinking about when I write, but it's definitely something that interests me. And it made a lot of sense to me when I read her saying this. Because I do think this focus on meaning, on causation, on arc, on plot, on denouement, you know, it's very clearly a means of trying to impose meaning on the world. You know, it's a way of trying to take control by being able to prescribe an almost kind of formulaic approach to living. And I just don't think that kind of thinking is necessarily useful right now in terms of our literature. You know, we're increasingly experiencing intense chaos, socioeconomic chaos, climate chaos, and that's not going away. And so you can't resect a character from their immediate environment, but you also, and therefore, and you know, and if you can't do that, then you can't pretend that there is controllable meaning in living. There is no, you know, A to B to C in terms of how we exist, in terms of how our actions are chartable, in terms of how the results of those actions are kind of quantifiable. I think meaninglessness is exactly what is necessary in literature. I think it's, you know, Alain Badiou talks about how, you know, it's better not to write anything than to contribute to modes which the empire has deemed acceptable. And, you know, I feel like plot, causation, narrative, meaning, those are all old hat at this point, and I don't think they're necessarily interesting, and I don't think they're good models for how we should think or how our literature should think.
But it makes people very angry when things don't make sense.
Yeah.
If you go on Goodreads, like, oh, the plot didn't add up.
Yeah, I mean, because, you know, I guess you can read it the other way too, and you can be like, you know, people... people maybe just want to enjoy literature.
I do wonder, like you were saying, like things are getting more chaotic and things. Are we going to demand in, you know, even more rigid forms of plot? I think you can kind of already like see that, like it's becoming more like, just duller.
You know, maybe that's going to become the ultimate sort of escapism, which is much more regimented fiction as a kind of salve to existence. But yeah, like you said, that seems so dull to me.
No, I'm all for meaninglessness. So let's go back to the Wesley story. The dialogue in the story is particularly memorable, and I know you also write really great dialogue. How do you approach writing dialogue? Is there anyone in particular that you admire? Does it well?
Laurie Murr. I think her dialogue is just 10 out of 10. Miriam Teaves as well, I think, is a really, really excellent dialogue writer. I think probably what I often, you know, revert to when I'm writing, and, you know, maybe that's why what drew me to this story as well, is very often my prolonged, said pro for a really long time, just drew out the word prolonged. And because I am actually a formal innovator.
That's what this podcast is about.
I will now only be saying words that I can somehow phonetically enact. Anyway, prolonged dialogue. It's often between two characters. And I think it's because I really love the kind of combative style you can then bring into that. You know, because something people famously hated about my first book was the fact it was called Tennis Lessons, despite not being a damn thing about tennis.
But were people annoyed about that?
Yeah, they were, yeah.
Did they think it was like an instructional book or something?
Oh, yeah, I think it was like going to be a Shirley Jackson, like how to win the lottery scenario. how to win at tennis lessons. but yeah, it's because I think I was kind of almost conceiving of a lot of the relationships within that book as being like either a tennis match or a tennis lesson, you know, this bouncing back and forth of the kind of conversational ball, gathering momentum, gathering speed, and I love watching how language can change over the course of a conversation, how a singular phrase can recur, can become a refrain, can snowball, take on this kind of new volition, this like life of its own through the act of speaking. And I think, dialogues are really enjoyable way for me to explore how language can change and become deeply personal and become imbued with the closeness or the sparring between two people. Seeing how language and jokes and refrains become this kind of collaborative medium where it's not just the words, it's the context in which they're being used, it's the tone and the mood of the conversation, allowing that transmutation to take place.
Yeah. I think you can see that, particularly in Common Decency, where these characters are, Siobhan in particular is, you know, anguished and waiting by the phone and things. But then when she's out in the actual world, she's very much, you know, able to hold a conversation. She's very funny. So there is this kind of gap between, and I mean, it's not like heavy throughout, you know, like people frequently are very funny and they're very funny in your book.
Thank you.
So talking about the story, and you were saying about talking about eco-fiction, in the Wesley story, obviously is running through the story is the need to have a child despite impending ecological collapse, or in the case, you know, ongoing. I think the story does a brilliant job of showing the tension of that desire. I don't know if you've read this essay that's in the LRB called "Is It Okay to Have a Child?" Have you
read this? No, I haven't.
It's extremely depressing. Here's the quote from it. Having a child is at once the most intimate, irrational thing a person can do, prompted by desires so deep we hardly know where to look for their wellsprings, and an unavoidably political act that increasingly requires one to confront not only the complex biopolitics of pregnancy and birth, but also the intersecting legacies of colonialism, racism, and patriarchy, all whilst trying to wrap one's head around the relationship between the impossible extremes of the political and the global. Fun. Do you think about climate change in your own work? Is that something that you think about? I don't think you do it in a very overt way, but because you write so well about your generation and things, I think it's in the background.
Yeah. I definitely think it's, you know, it's always there. And I think because so much of the fiction I write, you know, it's heavily influenced by what I learned from writing poetry. And poetry seems to me the form most well suited to thinking about these questions of the climate, because it is a form less overtly constrained by questions of capital and questions of narrative. You know, it's a form that can facilitate kind of radical rethinking of language. There's this incredible book called Garbage by A.R. Ammons, and that book, it's a book length poem, and just seeing how language mutates over the course of that book as a way of thinking about the world, as a way of thinking about the interactions between the human and the non-human, and seeing how he renders that in language, it becomes this, it's simultaneously so tightly controlled, but also there's almost this like echolalic quality of it. You know, the language is generating his thoughts as much as his thoughts are being rendered in language. And I think those questions, you know, to feed into this question of plot and narrative, you know, I think part of my aversion and resistance to that is because poetry isn't constrained by those things, and why should fiction be? So I think probably those are questions I'm thinking about that I think are symbiotic with thinking about the planet, which is, you know, how do we think about the individual? How do we think about the relationship between the I and the other? The kind of gulf between the public life and the private life. And, you know, how do we reconcile ideology with personal practice? Which I think is a big question in this idea of having children, which Wesley touches on in the story. Those are all questions I think are either explicit or implicit in what I'm trying to do, if not so much on a kind of actual content level. That kind of precarity of existence that kind of you have to account for when you're trying to write our mm-hmm. generation, because we're all feeling it.
Yeah, yeah.
I saw this great meme. I need to stop bringing my ideology back to memes. There was one day I was chatting to my friend. I said, read this great article about fast fashion. And she said, oh my gosh, really? Where was it published? And I was like, okay, no, it wasn't so much an article as it was a series of informative memes. But yeah, this meme was said something like, born too early to be a TikTok star, mm-hmm. born too late to own property,
yeah.
born at just the right time to spend 99p on a polyphonic ringtone. That really, really spoke to me.
Oh, buying ringtones. Those are the days.
Right? Yeah. I remember all the girls in my school had, do you remember Bad Day by Daniel Powter?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, oh, yeah. You would just hear that song ringing out through the school corridors, but obviously not the actual song, this kind of polyphonic rendering of it. So it's like...
They were horrible sounds, weren't they?
Awful. Yeah. Truly antithetical to everything music is, which is also kind of formally interesting if you think about it.
What you were saying there about the kind of never own property and things like that, I'm wondering about how it feels to read dystopic fiction when everything already feels dystopic. Do you know what I mean? There is that line, we'll never own a house, we'll never own bricks and mortar. And you're just like, well, yeah, obviously. You know, I feel like it's already, you know, we feel so close to full-on collapse that
even
this sort of stuff doesn't feel very real to me. Like in the few years, we'll be reading The Road, just being like, what a breezy read.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, this is my escapism.
Yeah, yeah. Beach read.
There aren't any beaches anymore, Nicole.
Oh no.
This is my sewage read. It's interesting, actually, because I was wondering about this specifically the other day, because I did this event with Guadalupe Nettle, and I've just read her new book Stillborn, and it's all about motherhood, and is about kind of this idea of collectivism in motherhood and how there is no singular track in terms of what it is to be or what it isn't to be a mother. You know, there are mm-hmm. unconventional forms of motherhood. You know, there mm-hmm. isn't strictly the biological sense, but also the kind of primary plot of that is the protagonist who is staunchly anti-children. Well, not anti-children, but anti herself becoming pregnant, but she becomes instead a kind of surrogate, contributing mother to this collective within her apartment block. But her best friend has decided to have a child, and but the child is diagnosed in the late stages of pregnancy with an abnormality that makes it seem like she won't live beyond birth, and even if she does live beyond birth, she won't live very far beyond that. But then against all the odds, the child does survive, but is obviously, you know, it's not a conventional motherhood story, and it's one tinged with a lot of complex feelings for the protagonist and also this friend who is the mother of the child. But despite kind of the more bleak facets of the story, it is very clearly to me, and I asked Guadalupe about this, and she said it was for her too, a book about hope, you know, a book about new ways to mother or different ways to think about mothering. Mm-hmm. And I was thinking about that in terms of just how much kind of very, very good but dystopian motherhood tangential literature there is. And I think of the two, I would gravitate more towards the one that was set in the immediate moment and captured all the kind of desolation and awfulness of existing now, but with that kind of kernel of, oh, here's how we can make things better. Mm-hmm. And I think probably what interested me about the Wes Lee story was it felt dystopian, but in such a complex way, in that, you know, the protagonist talks about overhearing couples talking in the supermarket about going on holiday to Fuji and buying and selling property. And I think the interesting thing about the story is the primary through line is one of dystopia, but you get this inkling that it's a singular, almost subjective dystopia, that mm-hmm. that not everyone is living in that way yet. And mm-hmm. you have these two protagonists who are very clearly preparing for this end of days, this inhospitable planet. And there are others who continue not to have to prepare for that. And I think that's a very, very interesting way of approaching dystopia, because as we would understand it right now, there are people living in what we would view as a kind of dystopia, you know, like people dying from mass flooding in Pakistan, for example, you know, the climate refugees who are having to like flee their homes. A novel written entirely within that world would probably be billed in the UK and Ireland as dystopia now, if it was an entire world overtaken of that in that way. But it's happening now, you know, the dystopia exists, and just because it hasn't encroached upon us yet doesn't mean it's not here. Mm-hmm. And I think that was what was interesting about, as well, about the Wesley story is it seemed to capture that, you know?
Mm. Yeah, I'm going to phrase something that I wonder if you feel the same way, but what I find kind of strange when I read something like the Wesley story is that it feels much more real when I encounter it in fiction than when I do encounter it in real life or online. Or I think it's because the conversation about, you know, like societal collapse or capitalism, or it's so breezy online. It's so, you know, it's just memes and like a funny tweet that you're like, ah. Like, so when I encounter, I think it's the shape fiction kind of puts on it, or it just appears, it's almost like, you know, what we're living right now is the dream and fiction is the reality. That might make me sound very odd, but did you ever find that in your own life? Does writing make it appear more real to you than?
Yeah. Because I wonder if this is almost not the desired effect, but definitely one of the very pronounced effects of being online, which is what global events capture the attention of the mass public. You know, what makes it into the zeitgeist, and how it is then rendered is often through this like reiteration of images, reiteration of jokes, recycled and remade, and kind of they allow to then fall victim to like the syntactic satiation. And at the same time, other events, other global atrocities, catastrophes that don't quite make it into the meme format are so quickly forgotten, become completely ephemeral. So at the same time, what we become entrenched in certain global events, but what that entrenchment, what that saturation means is that it ceases to have any real impact because it goes through this you know, repeated rendering in throwaway formats. Whereas I think fiction can escape that, that cycle. You know, you have to spend so much time with a story or a book to read it, and it requires requires attention, it requires engagement, and so it's a format, I think, much more kind of Twitter-proof.
And it gives you new images rather than the constant. But I just feel that the absurdity of what you kind of, you know, like I saw this press conference like last week, and it was Timothy Chalamet being like, societal collapses in the air, and you're just sort of like, oh, it is.
Yeah.
But like, I don't feel like seeing like an actor who earns X amount a year, like saying this at like a film festival and stuff, like if you put that in a novel, you'd just be like, oh, do you know? Like, I feel everything has moved beyond fiction.
So
it's just making fiction really hard. It's really hard to be a writer right now. I joke. It's easier than ever.
It's easier than being Timothée Chalamet.
For sure.
He's the real victim. You know.
It's hard to look that good.
His name is just a succession of noises.
I was quite nervous to pronounce it there. I doubt he's listening, though. I hope he is, but I doubt he is.
Hi, Timothée. We're so sorry.
So do you see what I that's how I kind of feel about particularly like eco fiction, and I'm trying to think of books that I've read that have done it. I feel like I remember reading Weather by Jenny Offal a few years ago, and that did it. The kind of strangeness of being online and real life, I suppose, was done quite well in that Patricia Lockwood book. Is there any books that you can kind of think of that eco fiction or?
I mean, this is very, very, very tangential. But I read Kobo Abe's The Woman in the Dunes a few months ago. And it's, you know, it was written in the 60s. So it's, you know, it's a different way of writing the world, obviously. But it's all set around this insectologist who goes to the sand dunes looking for this kind of beetle. And in doing this, he finds this entire community of people living in houses that are built into these sand dunes. And he asks for kind of safe passage there to stay in one of the houses one evening so he can get up bright and early and look for this insect again. And he's granted it, and he sleeps in the house. And then afterwards, when he wakes up in the morning, he's informed that he's not allowed to leave. That these houses are built in such a way that the sand dunes are always collapsing on top of them. And it is the role of the people living in the houses to be constantly shoveling this sand so that they don't get crushed to death under the weight of it. Mm-hmm. And everyone who comes to visit then gets kept there, becomes a kind of acolyte of this process of constant pointless shoveling of sand in dunes that are always collapsing on top of you, and it felt kind of it felt very much like a kind of eco fiction to me. This idea of, like, especially this idea that is so often propagated, this onus on individual responsibility, despite the fact that, you know, it's, I can't remember whatever percentage of global corporations are responsible for this percentage of carbon emissions. But we're made to feel bad, you know, you know, obviously fast fashion is terrible and awful. But, for example, I don't think buying a little pair of trainers in H&M is commensurate with what Shell is doing. But it's a very, very easy narrative to put forward because it absolves elected officials of having to challenge those who actually have the capacity to effect change. And it felt like a very apt kind of metaphor for that, you know, this man who has now been brought in to do this relentless shoveling, and he asks to leave, and he's made to feel guilty for wanting to leave, for not wanting to be crushed to death under this weight of sand.
One thing I think about when I think about like dystopic fiction or even films and things, I'm like, is the extreme version, like, you know, the fantasy, like where we, you know, we get to be heroic and you have to make these choices and things. And then, you know, the less kind of is just, you know, not flying or, you know, like the kind of more boring choices. No one's going to make, you know, a Children of Men type film out of that, you know? I don't think you can. Someone just choosing not to, someone get in the boat. But like, I just feel, are we just kind of, hiding in these kind of fantasies, these extreme versions that aren't real either, you know?
Because, you know, it appeals less to kind of this desire for nobility, you know? That you eat a bit less meat and you're doing a good thing, you know? It's not quite you swinging into a kind of erupting chasm in the earth to rescue a family of marmosets, you know,
which it's not as exciting.
It's just not as exciting.
So one thing in that story that it's sort of placeless, that story. But your work, and I'm sure you get this question a lot, isn't placeless. It's set in Belfast. Can you talk about that a little
bit? Well, earlier I said it was set in Paris.
So
who knows what I know? I apparently have
so I am telling you. I'm not like, Susie, your book says set in Belfast.
Belfast? Oh my God.
I feel that like, I one thing that I noticed in Common Decency is a book she really loves, Siobhan, is NW by Zadie Smith. And actually that book has come up in like quite a few recent fiction books I've read recently. I think it's mentioned in is it Cold Water?
Yeah, Open Water. Yeah.
Open Water, yeah it's mentioned. Yeah. And I feel like it's quite influential on probably the writers that are coming up now. The way she writes about London and things, did it influence the way you write about Belfast?
Yeah, I think so. Because, I mean, that book, I think, is truly incredible. I think it's doing so many different things, but something that is so intrinsic to it is this kind of psychogeography of Northwest London. And you see it from these three characters, their own different experiences of that. And yeah, that is something I really wanted to try and render, but for Belfast. Because I think probably, you know, if you hear a dual narrative novel set in Belfast, you might expect a certain thing, you know. You might expect a protagonist from the nationalist community, protagonist from the unionist community, ideologically polarities, ideological polarities. And I was never kind of interested in doing that, but I did want to kind of capture the kind of shifting face of the city depending on your emotional state as you inhabit it. And because, you know, I don't even know if I've ever really thought about this, but definitely... Yeah, NW was a big influence, I think, in how I wrote that, because I do think Belfast as a city is so interesting because it's relatively small, which means that the centre, South Belfast and the centre of Belfast are places where there are different kind of socio-economic spaces aren't held separate. South Belfast is obviously a kind of increasingly affluent place in that you've got the student community and also a lot of young professionals. But, you know, like I mentioned in the book, also on Botanic for a long time, there was a needle exchange. And that needle exchange was then closed down, I guess, because there was this idea that there shouldn't be people suffering with addictions encroaching upon the hallowed space of students or young professionals. But those people are still there. They are still living in that space, and just refusing to acknowledge them doesn't obliterate them from this place. And I think it's a very interesting city in terms of how the extremities of poverty and wealth sit spatially atop one another. And I was interested in, you know, trying to capture that, but also just interested in exploring what it is as a city now, what it is to be a 20-something woman moving through Belfast, what that means.
Yeah. When I think about your work, I don't think necessarily of other Irish writers. I think of someone, you know, maybe like Gwendolyn Riley, or someone like sticking quite close, like to the really lived experience of a young woman. Can you talk about that a little bit? Is that something you try and do?
Because I think, you know, I love Gwendolyn Riley so much because she so deftly navigates just the depths of despondency with levity, with humor, with the kind of farcical, pathetic nature of human existence. And in her work, those two things sit together so naturally. There's such a harmony between those two things, even as they're being presented in opposition to one another. It's, and I think that's something I'm always kind of trying to emulate as well, is I want to write these incredibly sad characters. And actually, because at one point, I think in some of the feedback I got, maybe it was after Tennis Lessons on Goodreads or one of those places, maybe it was after Comedy Sensei, but someone was like, why is this all so bleak? and I sent it to my agent and she said, well, if Gwendolyn Riley's allowed to do it, why aren't you allowed to do it? And I was like, well, probably people could make some very compelling arguments for why Gwendolyn Riley should be allowed to do it and I shouldn't, maybe because Gwendolyn Riley is doing it well. No. But yeah, no, I mean, that, yeah, the kind of capacity for in intense highs of humor, sitting alongside the kind of troughs of despair, I think is, exactly where I want to try and position my writing.
I think it's because that's exactly what, you know, life is kind of like, you know? I think you capture that really well. I watched a film recently. So again, I'm always bringing back to films. I can't read, actually. but I watched a film recently called Reprise. And it's just...
Okay.
And it was quite bleak. But, you know, there were these, like, long party scenes. And it was just very good at capturing that feeling, which is that you can feel very closed in and... you know, when you're alone in your bedroom or whatever, but once you're in a situation, you can still enjoy yourself and be caught up in that moment, which is involves like being in the pub or like being out. I feel like these two things aren't separate. So I feel like you capture that balance like extremely, extremely well, you know, just like Gwendolyn Riley.
Thanks.
The other thing you write well about is, and this is my own personal fascination, is wasting time. The characters. I love to. So how do you personally waste time? Is it like, not waste time, but I'm just sort of interested in like how writers spend time between books and procrastinate and think about things and life work balance.
I actually think this might be my favorite question ever because it is finally time for me to impose upon the world my silly little agenda, which is the system I have come up with. And I call it the tight 15.
Okay.
And what you do is you take a piece of visual pop culture, be that a TV series or a film, you read the plot synopsis on Wikipedia, you isolate the scenes you think will appeal to you personally, and then you only watch those scenes on YouTube. And it means you can absorb a huge amount of pop culture in a very short space of time.
It's a productivity hack. CJK's productivity hack.
I mean, I'm not sure I would class it as productivity when I'm doing it, like, instead of working, I'm reading, like, all seven kind of, like, series synopses of Riverdale. But I do think it's a way to kind of only engage with I'm going to sound like a fascist there. I personally should only have to engage with the images that interest me and appeal to my sensibilities. But no, you know, like I remember seeing how bereft people seemed to be after Game of Thrones ended, you know, how disappointing apparently that final season was. I did the whole show in 45 minutes, so I really didn't feel like I'd missing out
feel
on anything.
Anything at the end.
Yeah, I betrayal. Don't know her.
Yeah.
I only know the glorious streamlined nature of the tight 15.
And are you someone that between book do you like leave a lot of time between books? Are you always working on something new? Or
I think I tend to kind of always be doing something. I think if I'm not kind of thinking in terms of fiction, I'll have switched to poetry because, you know, I would rarely do poetry and fiction simultaneously. But yeah, I like to kind of, if I'm not working on a new novel, I'll be doing poemy things. Or it turns out, watching all the scenes from Hannibal where he eats people. Because, you know, no
is that
one
of
is,
your specialist interests?
Well, I feel like no one's watching Hannibal for the dialogue, you know?
I've never watched Hannibal.
Well, it's a treat if you're interested in cannibalism, which I am.
Well, that's great, Susie. I think we should leave it there. That's a final thought.
If I could eat one celebrity, it would
be. If you could eat one short story, which one would you? What's your favorite short story?
Oh, what's my favorite? Oh, okay.
Or give me a couple.
I think How to Be the Other Woman. By Laurie Murr, I think is 10 out of 10. The Second Person, or You Are the Second Person by Chiesa Leimon, is brilliant. And there's a Don DeLillo one, which I love, but I currently cannot remember the name of it, so that's not very helpful. Mm-hmm. But yeah, and the celebrity I would eat is Timothée Chalamet.
He'd be delicious.
I bet, yeah. Can't have a name like that and not be some sort of dessert.
Well, thank you, Susie. That was great. Great to talk to you, as usual. And read Common Decency. It's very, very, very good.
Thank you. Bye.
Thank you to the Arts Council for their support, and we'll see you again soon.